listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Buenas noches. Welcome. Welcome to the Central Library. I'm Maureen Moore, the Associate Director of the Aloud series. As we dive into the realm of all things radio tonight, I'd like to think that something as universal and democratic in form as radio, to the extent it is even the same word in Spanish and English, is a perfect match for what we stand for here at the library. Universal access to information, where people of all cultures, languages, and persuasions can seek, find, and pursue their interests. Radio Ambulante's proposal is actually to do just that, to present the stories of Latinoamericanos de todas las Américas en su voz nativa sin traducción. The Radio Ambulante team has put together a very special program for you. You're actually the first live audience to hear this precise format, pieces that were made for radio but come alive through the accompaniment of a narrated voice. The stories you'll hear tonight were produced by Ruxandra Guidi, KPCC's Immigration and Emerging Communities reporter, Nancy Lopez, a producer at Radio Ambulante, Annie Murphy, who reports for NPR from across South America, and Danielle Alarcón, the award-winning novelist of Lost City Radio. In preparing for tonight's program, I realized how Radio Ambulante presents us with a reflection of our own city in a myriad of ways, but primarily in the name itself, the word ambulante, to move about from one place to the next, with no fixed position or place, to roam. We Angelinos could very well be called ciudadanos ambulantes, en la manera en que cruzamos fronteras y barrios cada día, traversing through a city of ever-changing ideas, trends, and judgments. We live in a constant state of movement here, arriving, leaving, changing direction, shifting form, and we are constantly writing stories. Tonight we travel together into a world of bilingualism, of storytelling, into the richness of language that is only expressed and understood through voice and the spoken word. Please help me in welcoming tonight's guests, Danielle Alarcón, Adolfo Guzmán López, and the Radio Ambulante team.
I'm Adolfo, that's Danielle.
Hi, everybody.
Well, before we get started, bienvenido a Los Angeles.
Muchas gracias.
All right, a show of hands. Español. ¿Quién habla español? Okay, good, excellent. Oh, nice, we can do it. No español. Okay. Oh, okay, okay. So can you reach out and touch these people? Help them out. Bilingües? Bilingual people? Ah, nice. Nice. Well, I brought my two homies, Real and Academia de la Lengua Española. It's a little bit difficult for me. Bilingualism is, we'll talk a little bit about that later. We're going to talk English, Spanish, Spanglish. Daniel, your work is very well known, your work as a novelist, but when did the radio bug hit you? When is that seed planted?
I think I've always been sort of interested in radio. I come from a radio family. My old man was a soccer announcer back in Arequipa in southern Peru. And when he was 14, 15, he was the voice of football in southern Peru, calling games from the stadium. So we always sort of had that bug in us. And when I was growing up, you know, this was in the prehistory before Skype and internet and things like that. So we would make these kind of audio postcards for our family back home. And I didn't think of them this way at the time, but now I realize they were sort of little radio programs where we would gather in my parents' bedroom on a Sunday, and my father would take out the recorder and he would interview us and ask us what we were learning in school and, you know, tell your aunts and uncles and your cousins what's going on, what's new. My sister might read a poem or sing a song or something. And then we'd put those tapes in the mail to Lima. And 4 weeks later or 6 weeks later, depending on the whims of the Peruvian Postal Service, we'd get back something from Peru. And this was just, you know, how we stayed in touch. Those are really fond memories that I have, really nice memories that I have. And I think that's sort of the beginning point.
Now, for me growing up in Tijuana, one of the radio shows, this radio theater show, La Tremenda Corte, this comedy show was always, you know, this kind of farcical, you know, radio theater show. Going back to Guanajuato, for me, the radio shows of Calimán. In Mexico City, there's this radio station. It's an entire radio station called Radio Reloj. And okay, Reloj is watch. Okay, so think about that. They spend the entire time saying the time. Radio Reloj. They have some ads in between. Now, you'd go back to Lima, and there were some shows that really caught your ear, right?
Yeah, well, my first novel is called Lost City Radio, and it's based on a real program, on a show that was called Busca Personas. And the entire premise of the novel is pretty much built around the idea of the show, that it functions in Lima as a radio bulletin board where people call in and they tell these crazy stories, and they are looking to find missing people or loved ones that they lost touch with. And when I went back to Peru, obviously I was just fascinated by this for a variety of reasons, but one of them was just the intensity of the human drama in these, you know, little segments, you know, where these grand reunions where people hadn't seen each other for 10, 15 years. And it seemed really symptomatic of a city that to me was so chaotic and so overwhelming that it would be easy for people to disappear.
Well, and to what extent was that due to the war going on in Peru, that people disappeared?
I mean, partially the war, but partially also just the rapid growth. You know, if a city goes from, you know, 600,000 to 8.5 million in a generation and a half, you know, there's just not any way to keep that under.
And it's the loneliness of migration, isn't it? I mean, that's what...
Yeah, I mean, migration is a constant, and migration is internal and then external. I mean, you know, Lima grows because people from the countryside move to Lima, and then people leave Lima. You know, I feel like at a certain point when I was living in Lima, it did feel like I was going to a going-away party every few months. You know, or, people were going to study or going to try their luck elsewhere. Now it's changed, you know. I mean, the Peruvian unemployment rate is way lower than the California unemployment rate, so we should all be moving to Peru.
So would you come back and then, I mean, were you listening to radio in the United States? And, I mean, would you do, like, a compare-contrast? Or would you think, why can't I hear this kind of compelling radio back home?
Well,
you grew up in Alabama,
I did.
We need to say.
I did. I grew up in Alabama. And actually, we started listening to my introduction to NPR was based on my father hearing our budding Southern accents and being horrified. And then making us listen to NPR in the car on the way to school. And he's like, this is what you have to talk like if you want to get ahead in this country. And it was an astute observation. I mean, you know, he was like, Tom Brokaw doesn't talk, you know, like your neighbor. You know?
I think when you're bilingual, you have to listen. You have to be attuned to the accents, right? I remember, you know, I was born in Mexico City, so we went back a lot, and we have a lot of relatives in Mexico City accents. There are a lot of them, right? There's the very working class Chilango, very sing-songy accent. There's the Fresa accent. I mean, you grew up with a similar kind of ear to attuned to various accents, right?
Well, no. You know, I, when I moved back to Lima, I remember all my friends were like, man, you know, it's like talking to you is like talking to a time capsule, you know? Because you have all the slang and the intonations of like 1955 provinces from Arequipa, where your dad is from. You know, and he's like, people don't say that anymore. You know, and this was really embarrassing to me because I think I'm talking all like hip and like, and I'm dropping, you know, slang that is like they got to dust it off and be like, wait, what does that mean again? Look in your dictionary.
Well, you know, this is what's happened in New Mexico, right? There are little towns in New Mexico where they're speaking Spanish from the 18th century, right?
Sure. And, you know, and that's one of the things that I think is really been fascinating for me about this project is getting to hear accents from all over Latin America and from all over the U.S. and the different the different ways that people talk and the language they use to describe similar experiences. I mean, it's a really, you don't ever get to hear all of these accents side by side by side. And that's one of the things about being Latin American, Latino in the United States is, you know, if you're in Peru, you're most likely going to meet Peruvians walking down the street. But if you're here, you know, you go to a party in Oakland, in San Francisco, in LA, you're going to meet Ecuadorians and Guatemalans right. and Salvadorans and Colombians. And that's really fascinating, you know, and you get this cross-pollination.
So one of the experiences that really got you on the road to doing Radio Ambulante was you were commissioned to help out, to participate in a BBC radio documentary about Andean migration. And it was you told me before it was a tough experience. What was it about that kind of led you on this path to this very exciting project?
What happened was I'd been traveling for about a year promoting Radio Ambulante. I'm promoting my novel, Lost City Radio. And I was ready to take a break, and I was about to go home and just relax. And then I got this call, and they were like, will you do this? And I jumped at the chance. It was the last trip of the year, and it was the hardest trip of the year because I'd been on book tour, which is just saying the same thing over and over again, over again. And suddenly I had this taskmaster of a producer from London who was like, go sit in that bench, write what it means to be from this town. You've got 20 minutes and I'm going to record you. And I'd have to like scribble down an essay and actually think and then record it into this mic. And so he followed me everywhere and we did all these different interviews in Lima and in this province. So I was talking mostly about Andean migration to the capital. And I loved the experience. It was like thinking on your feet and really sort of engaging with people and talking and interviewing, and I just loved every minute of it. I didn't get to participate in the editing process. He took all the tape back to London, and 6 weeks later sent me the mix. And I didn't, I wasn't like I could say yes or no. It was like, this is it, it's done. And it's a great piece, you know. But of course, you always start second guessing. You're like, what I might have done it differently if I'd been in the studio. I would have said, you know, how about that interview? And one of the things that really stood out was that a lot of the voices in Spanish didn't make it to the final cut. Because obviously it's a BBC documentary, 45 minutes. If it's all in voiceover, it's going to be terrible. Aesthetically, it just doesn't work. So it was a little frustrating, you know, because we had the interviews that I found were most memorable weren't in the piece. So that's when I started thinking, I was like, you know, there should be a space for this.
So before we listen to some of the great work that you've produced, NPR is so, it appears so dominant nationally, right? It's ever present, especially within a certain group of people. We joke in the station of, you know, the kind of Trader Joe's, wine sipping, cheese eating, master's degree holding crowd.
All right, guilty. Yeah.
What do you think of the Latino presence on NPR?
There isn't much of one, to be quite honest, and that's not news to anybody. I think the programs that we respect a lot and like a lot don't often, shows like This American Life or Radiolab, Snap Judgment Radio, a bunch of shows. Latino pieces on This American Life are few and far between. When they do them really well, because they do everything really well, but the demographic, the stories they seem most comfortable telling are not those.
And this is going to become a big problem. I mean, in LA, we see the demographics, and the rest of the country is living this demographic change. So they've got to change at some.
Well, yeah,
point,
no,
right?
I don't know what the folks at CPB are thinking, but that's Corporation Public Broadcasting, and I think they're probably looking at the same demographics that you're looking at, and the same demographics, you know, Jan Brewer is looking at, and they're just as scared as anybody else. You know, I mean,
she stews in her juices.
They do have to incorporate and reach out to us. You know, I mean, they have to.
Well, let's give Daniel a hand and his producers a hand to encourage them as we listen to a live presentation of Radio Ambulante.
Welcome to Radio Ambulante Mudanzas Live. We begin this evening in Tijuana at the world's busiest border crossing. It's rush hour and a mass of pedestrians head into the United States, each one with a particular mission and the baggage to prove it. Some are carrying suitcases, others school backpacks. Producer Ruxandra Guidi is among them, looking for a U.S. border guard named Angelica De Sima.
When I find her, she's straight-faced and a little nervous. wearing the official navy blue of Customs and Border Protection. I've come to learn about what she does, what this border looks like to her. She must be baking beneath this unforgiving sun.
All right, so we'll just head out. We're going to follow you guys. We'll probably be about 10 feet away from you as you do your job. She's not going to interview you or anything like that.
Technically speaking, we're still in Mexico, but there's no question who's in charge of this part of the border. Angelica and I are facing the U.S. Behind us, the endless rows of idling cars extend deep into Tijuana. To our right, the long, orderly line of pedestrians heading the same direction. We walk a few steps behind another officer and his guard dog, zigzagging our way through the cars heading into San Diego. The smoke and the heat radiating from the engines is making me nauseous.
Okay, let's go.
That is
Captain
14. Go ahead.
All right, you guys. Run, we'll just follow you.
Lane 15.
Looks like we have alien smuggling. Lane 15.
Then I hear one of the agents calling out the number 915. And this, it turns out, is at least part of the reason for the traffic jam. 915, that's code for human smuggling. A couple of other guards rush past us, the guard dog leading the way. Angelica and I race after them. And we come to an old Honda Accord being driven past a booth by a U.S. guard. The middle-aged man who was at the wheel is staring down at his feet while another guard leads him away from the car in handcuffs. My interview with Angelica had barely begun. And now this.
You see this every day, people trying to come into the country hidden in the trunks, and even deeper concealment methods, like a specially built compartment. A lot of times we call them coffin compartments. People cannot get out of them, and it is dangerous.
To say that it's dangerous is an understatement. It's a rectangular box made up of pine wood planks and metal sheets held by wires and rigged to the undercarriage of this old car. It's so low to the ground, it must have been banged up so many times along the ride.
Yeah, they've been in there for a while.
I'm with Angelica and about a dozen other guards, and we're all gathered around the old cream-colored Honda. Everyone's eyes are on that trunk. And one of the guards, a young Latino guy with a heavy build and jet black, intense eyes, reaches into it, and deeper still, into the makeshift compartment underneath it. I stop breathing for a moment and look around. We're all staring shamelessly, as if trying to predict who or what will come out. The young guard grabs onto a hand, ever so carefully, and then pulls out the whole arm. Then the shaking and sweaty body of a kid, probably 15 or 16. He has indigenous features and a skinny, long body. He looks terrified, and my heart sinks as we make quick eye contact. He's not saying a word, but then again, what could he say? The Honda's engine is still running, spewing smoke right into our faces. Then the guard reaches in again. And again. And then again, three more people come out of this tiny space, an absolutely impossible number emerging from under this car. Four people in all. A second young man and two girls, probably in their teens. They have no shoes, no IDs, or bags of any kind, just bodies, scarcely alive from the looks of them. Who knows how long they've been stuck in traffic inside this wooden box? Angelica seems desensitized by the whole thing.
The first time I found somebody in the trunk, I think I was more nervous than the driver. I mean, you're looking for it, but it's shocking the first time you actually find people in the trunk.
I can imagine. This is my first time seeing someone in a trunk, and I feel nothing else but helplessness, shame, and sadness. I mean, I know this happens every day at the border for many years, but it's different when you see it.
Oftentimes when people have been in the trunks of the vehicle, especially on a hot day in the summertime especially, oftentimes they can be in that vehicle for hours at a time, and they come in kind of looking like these folks.
These folks are looking tired, hot, sweaty, dehydrated. Sometimes, Angelica tells me, they're pulled out unconscious. Though I try, of course, I'm not allowed to talk to the girls and boys who've just been taken from the coffin compartment. They're lined up on the curb, still shoeless, and they won't meet my gaze. Moments later, they're taken away. I've worked on the border on and off for years, long enough to know that as soon as they're sent right back, they'll pull all their energy and whatever little money they can get into crossing again. And because I've talked to so many people on this side, men and women who've made the same crossing, I know this too. If they keep trying, they're likely to make it.
Ruchanda Guidi covers immigration for KPCC. Fue en agosto del año pasado en un gimnasio aquí en Los Ángeles donde conocí a Mayer Olortegui. Tiene 73 años y practica boxeo 3 veces por semana. Se le nota. Es bajo, fuerte, musculoso a pesar de su edad, de sonrisa fácil y un toque vanidoso. La verdad es que Mayer es un luchador en todo el sentido de la palabra. De niño, su lucha fue por la supervivencia en las calles del Callao, en Perú. Así fue como conoció a su mejor amigo, Mario. Mario le enseñó a Mayer a robarse puñados de arroz en las mangas de la camisa. Se iban juntos al puerto a limpiar barcos de pesca, ganándose 10 centavos por barco y alguito de comer. Era una vida dura. De niños desafiaron el hambre, pero de grandes les tocó desafiar la muerte. Nuestra productora Nancy López cuenta la historia de estos dos amigos y la aventura que marcaría sus vidas.
Es una tarde calurosa en el Callao, 1959. Dos amigos se vuelven a encontrar después de varios años. Mayer, de 18, era estibador y ya había cruzado el Atlántico un sinfín de veces. Su amigo Mario, de 25, nunca había salido del barrio humilde donde ambos crecieron. Después de los abrazos, se ponen al día. Mario escucha las aventuras de Mayer atentamente y se anima a hacerle una propuesta.
Hey, ahí hay un barco que va a salir, me dice. ¿Por qué no nos vamos ahí escondidos en el barco? Yo le dije, no, me da miedo. Me dijo, vamos, yo conozco. Entonces yo me animé.
Esta historia me la cuenta Mayer en una de sus 7 tiendas en Los Ángeles. Está rodeado de vestidos de quinceañera de todos los colores. Y aunque han pasado más de 50 años desde ese viaje, lo recuerda como si fuera ayer. Mayer se sienta detrás del mostrador. Toma una hoja de papel color rosita que está ahí a la mano. Agacha la cabeza y empieza a dibujarme un mapa. La ruta hacia el norte que los llevaría a Estados Unidos.
Ok, Callao, para acá, Nueva York, aquí, New York, aquí.
El barco salía de Perú para Nueva York, subiendo por la costa de Ecuador, Colombia, cruzando el canal de Panamá, por el Golfo de México, hasta el Atlántico. Mayer, que ya había navegado esa ruta, calculó que serían unos
13 días. Eso es lo que yo tenía pensado. Y nos preparamos conservas de tuna, preparamos agua, preparamos pastillas para el dolor de cabeza, medicinas, otras cosas, un cuchillo grande llevamos una flashlight también y nos subimos.
La noche antes de que partiera el barco, se escondieron en la última bodega.
Tienen unos hoyos que de ahí ponen una soga que está en el muelle, está amarrado. Entonces nos subimos por aquí, por la soga. Y ahí nos quedamos.
Día siguiente, el barco emprendió su camino. Llevaba toneladas de carga de fruta, de verdura, llevaba 200 estibadores de más de una docena de países y 2 jóvenes peruanos. Bien escondiditos en la última bodega, Mayer y su amigo Mario, cada quien acostado, agarrado de una tabla de madera en la oscuridad total.
No se veía nada, nomás que el flashlight lo usábamos para comer, para mirarnos, para preguntarnos cosas y lo apagábamos. Y así. Y sentíamos siempre el pum, pum de la mar, ¿no? y el movimiento del barco, pues pum, 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 pum. Eso siempre lo sentíamos.
De vez en cuando platicaban de la incomodidad del viaje, del sacrificio, pero a fin de cuentas eran dos amigos pasando una aventura juntos. Si bien era difícil, no era imposible, o por lo menos así lo veían. Después de una semana, la oscuridad y el movimiento del barco se volvieron insoportables.
Estás sintiendo los golpes, pa, pa. El barco se levanta, sí. Hay oleajes de 40 pies de alto que tapan el barco. ¿Me entiendes? El barco a veces sube así, así, y después cae, pum, pum, así. Todo es oleaje, todo es ruido, pues no se sabe ni los días que uno está ahí, porque no puedes ver la luz del día, solamente ves oscuro. Es horrible, es horrible. Muchas veces llorábamos también.
Y así pasaron 13 días.
Ya no teníamos comida. Entonces ahí empezamos a buscar en las cargas manzanas, melones, sandías.
Pero algo no cuajaba. Se habían pasado los 13 días, deberían estar ya en Nueva York. A la incomodidad del viaje se suma una incertidumbre aterradora. Y es así que un viaje difícil se convierte en una verdadera tortura.
Mi amigo me pregunta, ¿dónde estamos? Como estamos en la última bodega, yo le dije, ¿Panamá? No, porque yo pensé que el barco había ido así. Le dije, yo creo que es Panamá, pero tal vez Colombia. Y yo le dije, pues hey, yo no sé, no sé qué cosa ha hecho el barco. Solamente tratábamos de sobrevivir.
Sobrevivir y no perder la esperanza. Pero poco a poco el cuerpo les iba fallando. Siempre sentados, con la espalda contra la pared, les dolía todo, los pies, las piernas, la espina dorsal. Apenas se podían mover. Llegó un momento en que Mario ya no podía pararse.
Entonces yo le traía la comida a él. Y tienes que sentir así a tu amigo. Es horrible, horrible.
Poco después cayó Mayer.
Ya faltando, yo pienso que como unos 4 días ya no, pues ya no podía subir para allá, para la otra bodega, a sacar, a traer comida. Me sentía bien débil.
No había más que hacer sino esperar.
Es mi amigo, me decía ya que nos agarren, que nos boten, que hagan cualquier cosa con nosotros. Y yo le decía, no, Mario, ten fe. Ya de ahí solamente sentimos que el barco se paró. Yo agarré el cuchillo, porque yo pensé que todavía estábamos navegando, que nos podían botar a la mar. Entonces los que nos alumbraron dijeron, no. Y ahí nos preguntaron de dónde veníamos. Yo le dije al hombre y el hombre le salió las lágrimas.
Había un estibador griego que hablaba algo de español. Le preguntó a Mayer la fecha que se subieron al barco.
Él fue a averiguar con los oficiales de ahí. Él vino, no, dijo, él nos dijo. El barco salió de Callao esa fecha, se fue para Chile. No fue para Panamá, fue para Chile. Después volvió a Callao. De Callao ya vino para acá ya a regular, me dice.
O sea que el viaje no fue de 13 días, ni de 15, ni de 20.
26 días, nos dijo el griego.
26 días de hambre, de oscuridad, de miedo. Pero llegaron vivos finalmente a Nueva York. Los estibadores los limpiaron a manguerazos y les dieron de comer. A las 5 de la tarde los sacaron del puerto, escondidos en unos vagones. A Mayer le dolía todo, pero Mario estaba peor. Él apenas podía caminar.
Nos dejaron en una esquina en la calle que se llama Columbus, el Columbus and 26, y nos pusieron $5 en la bolsa cada uno. Buena suerte.
Horas después de salir del puerto, Mayer y su amigo Mario se encuentran en el vestíbulo de un edificio en Brooklyn, tomando sopa con las manos. Una señora les ha dado un par de suéteres de mujer para que se abriguen y no saben qué hacer. Hasta que Mario tiene una idea, otra propuesta, que sin querer le marcaría la vida a Mayer.
Hacemos una cosa, me dice. De la puerta, mira la puerta, ¿para dónde te quieres ir? ¿Para la derecha o para la izquierda? Yo digo, no sé, Mario. Me dijo, yo me voy para la izquierda, tú te vas para la derecha. Algún día nos vemos, me dijo. Tú sabes, me dijo, yo soy más vivido que tú, ¿no? Por eso te dije que escojas para dónde. La derecha es mejor. Y así fue. Nos separamos y justo a la derecha había una entrada al subway. Fue muy triste. Muy triste porque, pues, pasar cosas así juntos, ¿no? Y así es el destino, pues, mija.
Los dos amigos no se volverían a ver por otros 10 años. Para entonces, sus vidas ya habían ido por dos caminos muy diferentes. Así nos cuenta Mayer.
Estoy entrando a la deli. Y Mario iba saliendo con un six-pack. Y me mira así, yo lo miro a él. ¡Mayer! Me dice yo, ¡Mario! Y nos abrazamos y ¡híjole, qué encuentro!
Nunca se volvieron a ver.
Tenemos un... El gran honor de tener a Mayer Olortegui acá con nosotros esta noche y realmente es un gusto para todos del equipo tenerte y poder saludarte, por favor. Mayer, perdón. Un aplauso para Mayer. Maestro, realmente de las personas más impresionantes que he conocido en mi vida. Es impresionante. Nancy López is a producer for Radio Ambulante, born and raised in LA. Give her a hand, please. If you're looking for a quinceañera dress, you got to talk to Mario after. All the best. This next piece comes from producer Annie Murphy, who spent much of the last year in Honduras looking at the overthrow of President Manuel Zelaya. And sometimes when you're reporting one story, others appear that are just as incredible. And that's what happened here when Annie met a young Honduran who felt this coup from thousands of miles away as if it were just another chapter in his own family's history. Annie.
So a few months ago, I was in D.C. heading to Honduras to report this radio series for NPR. And right before I leave, I interview a young Honduran diplomat named Rodolfo Pastor. We sit down, and so I can check the microphone, I just ask him an easy question, what he ate for breakfast. But instead of answering that, he says,
I'm going to tell you about how my ancestors got to Honduras.
And he just goes. The story starts over a century ago with this guy from Paris named Henry Fasquelle.
He was a young doctor, he was 33. He was traveling around in a ship, and he really liked this girl.
So young Henry starts to pursue this woman. I imagine him balancing her teacup on rough seas, maybe holding an umbrella while she walks on deck, whispering sweet nothings to her in French. But there's a catch.
This other friend that was traveling with him also liked her, and they actually started fighting over her.
So Henry and his friend have to figure out who gets the girl. They decide to settle the matter like any self-respecting men of their day. They get out their guns.
They fought a duel on the ship, and he killed the friend.
On top of having just killed his friend, there's another problem. Duels are illegal in the motherland back in France. Henry is screwed. The captain of the ship says to him, listen.
If you come back with me to France, you know, you're going to go directly to jail. I can give you the opportunity of getting down in the next port.
The next port is Honduras. So Henry trades his home, Paris, for this remote country that he knows almost nothing about. And the girl doesn't even get off the ship with him. But he meets a woman in Honduras, the daughter of a landowner. They get married. That's how this whole family ends up there. And as Rodolfo continues, I start to realize exile is actually sort of a family tradition.
Okay, my name is Rodolfo Pastor, and I am from Honduras and from Mexico.
Honduras and Mexico. He was raised in Honduras, but born in Mexico. And that's because his father was exiled too. Back in the 70s, there was this military dictatorship in Honduras. And Rodolfo's father?
He used to write in the papers and question them. And because he came from a privileged background, he was not executed as some other people who were critical of the regime were, but he was recommended to leave.
Recommended to leave. That means someone in the military calls up someone in the family and tells them to get Rodolfo's father out, or they're going to kill him. So his dad becomes an exile. He goes to Mexico, falls in love with a Mexican woman. They marry, have three kids, and then they make their way back to Honduras, where Rodolfo's radical, revolutionary father becomes a cow farmer. I went out to the farm. They have 400 head of cattle there, out in the middle of this lush tropical forest, where you wake up in the morning to the smell of rain and fresh milk. For Rodolfo, that's home. But all of it got called into question a few years ago, when Rodolfo started working in D.C. at the Honduran embassy. At first, it was just a cool job. But then, a coup happens in Honduras. The president, that guy who sent Rodolfo to D.C., gets thrown out, and mayhem breaks out at the embassy. Part of the staff, like Rodolfo, is loyal to the ousted president. And another faction sides with the coup plotters. And all of them, all of these people, are holed up together inside the embassy.
It ultimately was them in a section of the embassy and us in a different section. We were confronted only when maybe we coincided in going to get water or something, you know?
Even then, they pretend the others don't exist. It's like when little kids fight and refuse to talk to each other, even though they share a bedroom. Except these people are grown-ups, and they're also diplomats. Eventually, the U.S. government backs the deposed president, Rodolfo's boss, and kicks the coup supporters out of the embassy. But Rodolfo still can't go home because he's in trouble with the coup government. Now, he's become an exile, too. Last year, the U.N. named Honduras the most violent place in the world. When I was there, it seemed people had come to understand violence sort of like bad weather. It was challenging, but ordinary, and inevitable. One day I was having coffee with two women who work in human rights, and I was floored when they stopped talking homicide rates and casually started to discuss when they themselves were going to be killed, how they might be killed. To them, there was no question of whether it was going to happen. Things get worse at night there. So when the sun started to set, these two women and everyone else on the street rushed to get home and bolt the doors, just so they could lock themselves inside their houses. I'll admit that it's really hard for me to imagine calling a place like that home. But Rodolfo does.
I will definitely go back, and if I have to go back alone, that might be the case. But I would love it if I could go back with my wife.
So a month before the coup, he got engaged to an American. There's clearly a pattern in this family. You get exiled, you have adventures, get a wife, and sooner or later, you end up on the farm with the cows back in Honduras. The men in this family are skinny, with narrow beards and bright eyes. They remind me of the way I picture Don Quixote. And their story always makes me think of a line from that book. It goes, for the sake of liberty, as well as honor, one can and should make life an adventure. For if not, captivity is the worst thing that can befall a man. And with Rodolfo's family's story, I think I finally understand that there are different kinds of captivity. There are the places you can get shut into, like a jail cell or your house, and then there are places that you can get shut out of, like your homeland. Thanks.
Annie Murphy works at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. Give her a hand. Ahora, cada mudanza tiene sus retos, pero quizás el más difícil es adaptarse. Antes de los 10 años, Reza Salazar había vivido en Perú, en una media docena de pueblos colombianos y en el norte de Argentina, donde nació su madre. Pasó la infancia viajando hasta 1999, cuando él y su mamá se mudaron a Estados Unidos, a Carolina del Sur, donde tenían unos familiares. Digamos que no fue una transición fácil. Su primer día del colegio lo resume todo.
La primera vez yo no hablaba un carajo, o sea, nada, nada de nada, ¿me entendés? Y estábamos afuera, estábamos en la puerta, o sea, yo no veía a los estudiantes. Y yo estoy acostumbrado a saludar a la gente. Yo me acuerdo que en Argentina, los estudiantes, cuando venía alguien nuevo, le cantábamos una canción de bienvenida, ¿me entendés? Y yo me asomo a la puerta y hago la cosa, hago hi, así con la mano. Y toda la clase se empieza a cagar de risa, ¿me entendés? Se empiezan a cagar de risa así. Y yo, antes de sentarme, uno de los muchachos me agarra y me jala la silla y me caigo de culo en el piso. Y yo me reía. Yo me reía por todo, del nerviosismo. O sea, quizás quería llorar en aquel tiempo, pero yo me reía de todo. Pues me acuerdo que hasta la profesora se rió. Pero eso fue mi primer día de escuela en los Estados Unidos. Ya después me di cuenta, cuando los niños entran a la clase por primera vez, no dicen un carajo. Mientras más serio estás, es lo más normal.
Sufrió un año y luego él y su madre se mudaron una vez más. En esta ocasión se fueron a Carolina del Norte, a Durham. Reza llegó en el año 2000, justo antes de la gran ola de latinos que le cambiaría el rostro a este estado. Es que hasta hace muy poco en Carolina del Norte solo había dos grupos que, claro, no necesariamente se llevaban bien, los blancos y los negros. Entonces el reto era integrarse a la vida de su nuevo colegio secundario, lo que se llama el high school en inglés.
Yo no tenía idea de todas estas formalidades y estructuras de high school, ¿me entendés? Que hay acá en Estados Unidos, que son muy, muy americanas. O sea, cualquier persona que le preguntes que ha ido a high school acá, high school te marca la vida a muchas personas. Y tú sabes que hay muchos cliques y están en la segregación, es impresionante, especialmente en el lunch, ¿me entendés? Yo llego con mi tray así de comida y veo los negros acá, los blancos acá, y la mesita de international asiáticos con un par de mexicanos, latinos allá al fondo. ¿Me entendés? Y yo era con mi tray y yo no sabía dónde ir, dónde ponerme. Y yo no sé cómo pasó que me senté en la mesa de los negros. Yo no hablaba inglés en aquel tiempo. Me aceptaron y al día siguiente fue lo mismo. Casi mi primer año fue con la mesa de los negros. Yo era el único latino sentado con todos los African Americans de la escuela. Pero eso fue mi introducción a este país. Entonces yo después del mes empecé a bajarme los pantalones anchos, me empecé a comprar los Timberland boots, hasta me puse cornrows. Tenía el pelo largo y me puse los cornrows porque yo quería hacer todo lo que ellos hacían. Había una cosa que me habían dicho que no tenía que decir, que era negro en español porque se parecía mucho a nega o nigger. Eso fue una de las primeras cosas que me dijeron, pero nunca me explicaron por qué. ¿Me entendés? Me dijeron, nunca digas eso, pero nadie realmente me dio una explicación concreta.
La explicación que no le dieron a Reza es la siguiente. Hay ciertas palabras con mucho poder, mucha violencia, con mucha historia, demasiada historia, palabras que hierren. En este caso, nigger es uno de los peores insultos que se puede lanzar hacia un negro en Estados Unidos. Esas dos sílabas arrastran todo un pasado. memorias de la esclavitud, de un racismo durísimo que forma parte de la herencia histórica de Estados Unidos, historia bastante viva, más aún en un lugar como Carolina del Norte.
Y yo en la mesa, yo escuchaba a estos muchachos que decían nigga all the time, o sea, todo el tiempo, se me hey, what's up, my nigga, hey, nigga.
Pero nigga sin la R es otra cosa. Todo lo opuesto, es una palabra de afecto, de cariño, la transformación de esa carga histórica. Es una palabra que se usa mucho en las comunidades afroamericanas, pero exclusivamente entre ellos.
Entonces yo por mi anhelo de querer ser parte de la cultura, yo iba a mi casa todos los días y practicaba decir la palabra nega. Y era mi deseo poder decirla en la mesa a uno de los muchachos. Pero ya estaba traumado porque me habían dicho que nunca. Entonces, pero yo decía, ¿pero por qué? Ellos son mis amigos. Y cada vez que llegaba al cafetería lo quería decir y nunca podía. Nunca podía, me moría por decirla. Al final de año, casi el primer año, yo dije, me armé de valor y dijo, esta vez la tengo que decir. Tenía 15 años, 14 años, era lo más importante en mi vida. Tenía que decir la palabra nega a mis amigos. Y entré a la cafetería, me senté. Justo al final del lunch, lo miro a mi mejor amigo, que era como el líder de todo el table, y digo, hey, what's up, my nigga? Y yo, eran como 3 segundos que dije, acá me matan, me sacan la mierda, ¿me entiendes? Oh, yeah, what's up, my nigga? Y me dio la mano, y yo era como que, sí, por Dios, sí. Lo pude decir, y era como que por primera vez me sentí 100% parte de la familia.
Reza Salazar no paró de mudarse, ahora es actor y vive en Nueva York. Quiero inventar al escenario a Adolfo, por supuesto, and Martina Castro, our wonderful and talented senior producer for Radio Ambulante. Give her a hand, please.
Sorry, I was aggressive with that hug.
Gracias.
Wow. Opa,
che. That's called feedback.
All right.
This last piece really gets to the heart of language, understanding, when you arrive someplace and you don't understand and you want to belong and you want others to accept you and you don't speak the language. I mean, Reza befriends, and I know some people in the audience didn't, I was in Spanish, so I'm sorry, so I'll sum it up.
I think sure. You should. I think you should.
Reza is an immigrant from South America. He arrives at a South Carolina high school. He doesn't speak a lick of English. There's the international table over here, Asians and Latins over here. And then there's the black kids, right? And so he goes to the black kids, and he's having a great old time. He gets cornrows and everything, and he starts learning the language of the black kids. And in Spanish, well, you use the word negro, and he discovers the N-word, and he discovers the N-word with the A-H at the end. And the culmination of it, and you got to go back to Radio Ambulante and listen to that again, the culmination of it is that point of understanding, the point of being accepted because of the language, right?
Yeah, I mean when I interviewed Reza for 3 hours, and this was just one.
That's
of
the, it? I would assume.
No, we did an hour and a half in May of last year, and then an hour and a half again in August, and this was like the last 20 minutes of the last interview he told his story of arriving and trying to adapt. And it's just such a moving story. It's funny. It's real. You know, I grew up in the South, too, when there was only two categories. There's only, black or white. And, for everyone else, you were just kind of like, hello, over here, you know? So I really identified with this story. I really sort of understood it at a real personal level. And but, it's hard. I was raised in the United States. You don't say that word, Yeah. And that's something that you learn and you internalize, and you just know that it's not okay to say that. But Reza was one of those people who's, well, why? Why can't I say it? Everyone else is saying it. All my friends are saying it. Like, why can't I say it? And it was just a really small moment
And that sometimes it just takes a small moment to tell a great story, but it was a very small but very moving moment. You know?
I've talked to Spanish-speaking immigrants in the L.A. area, and there's an interesting change between, you know, they don't use the word negro in Spanish anymore. They use the word moreno. They changed it. And I've talked to some of them because they say they live side by side with African-Americans, and the African-Americans hear the Spanish word negro, and they misunderstand it.
Sure.
Right? Martina, how do you talk through these stories and get at the heart of what the story is?
Well, at Radio Ambulante, we really want to bring it alive with as much sound and as possible. So, you know, if you, it's sort of a contract we have with our listeners, that silent contract, that, you know, most of these things are all sound effects, everything, actually. I mean, this was just one interview that Daniel had with Reza. But he was describing so many scenes that we wanted to take liberty and bring that alive. And so so we knew, you know, in the editing process, we're not only looking for the best, most emotional pieces of tape, as we call it still, and scenes, but also things that where we are allowed to play as producers and enhance it for your imagination as well.
The bells and whistles.
The bells and whistles. That's where we have a grand old time.
Now, I regress, what was it, about 10 years ago, This American Life published this comic book where they laid out the formula, right? There's a formula, and for those of you listening to This American Life for a long time, you know it, right? And I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was kind of laying out the characters, kind of leading to a kind of tension, and then the conclusion, the transformative element of the various characters, right? And that's what you do,
every
right?
Every good story has the same parts. It's got... And in radio, especially, because you can't go back, you can't read that paragraph one more time. You really have to capture people with every word. So we're very careful with how we write, because it has to be conversational. We have to grab you with the rhythm of someone's read, and so we're very conscious of dividing up, you know, what Daniel is saying and what the other person is saying, so to make sure to change it up. But also, you know, we want you to be thinking, what's going to happen next? Oh, what's going to happen next? And so there's a beginning, a climax, and an end. And yes, the tension has to be increasing and release.
The other thing that this made me think of is some of the discomfort of not speaking the language in here is some of the discomfort that I notice in monolingual Americans. I wrote a piece about bilingualism in my Movimiento column on KCT's website, and I got this guy commenting on it, you know, the typical, you know, kind of one language, you know, kind of English only comment. Mm-hmm. And hearing Spanish makes people uncomfortable in the United States, doesn't it?
Hmm.
When they don't understand it.
I really think it depends
more
on where
than other
from.
Languages.
Yeah.
If they hear French, oh, French is fine. German's fine.
That's really interesting.
Even Armenian is fine. But they hear Spanish.
Well, you know, I grew up in Alabama when speaking Spanish was like speaking Esperanto, you know, in the 80s. and it was, I mean, it was great. I mean, like the game that my father and I would play was like, let's talk about the person sitting right next to us.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And it was just like, you know, people watching, you know, and you could, you know, we could people watch, you know, you. You know, you wouldn't even know it. And the thing was, and whenever we met a Spanish speaker, it was like, you know, like Livingston, I presume. You know, it was like just, you know, like you just want to be their friends, you know, like where are you from, you know?
Oh,
Alarcón
yeah.
de Peru, you know, usted, ¿dónde viene? You know?
Now, Alabama's changed so
dramatically,
much since
yeah.
then. How do you feel about kind of the anti-Mexican environment in
well,
Alabama?
Well, that's the thing that's amazing. It's like, it's you know, we were completely under the radar because there was like 15 Peruvian families in our neighborhood. We all knew each other, and you know, we could barely get, you know, a 6-on-6 soccer game going, you know, and then now I went back a couple of years ago, well, like 18 months ago, to give a talk, and they had in October, and they had a Latin American festival with like 20 countries represented and hundreds of people there in the parking lot of the like local baseball stadium or something. I mean I'm not that old. That wasn't that long ago in the 80s. You know, that was recent, and it's just like that. It's amazing.
And you can't play that game anymore.
And I can't. Yeah, no. Now I can't play that game. Everyone.
Now, Martina, you've gone through NPR and kind of gone through the network. How does it feel to do this kind of work and compare to what you were able to do. Tell me a little bit about what you did at NPR.
Well, I started my career in radio at NPR as a producer, and I worked a lot in the field with national reporters who still go out with producers when they can, and so there's a team of a producer and a
reporter. I don't get to do that. I know.
I now work at a local station, and yeah, we do it all. We're a one-man team. But it was great because I really got immersed in just the power of telling stories through sound. And when you're a producer, you just focus all on the sound, collecting little, you know, door slams and things in the field to bring things, scenes alive. And you know, I really learned the basic NPR format of a report. And you know, to call it basic it's easy to say that now because we've gone so far from that with Radio Ambulante. But I mean, it's incredibly powerful. I definitely don't mean to take away or ever criticize the NPR style because I think it's super powerful, and that's why it speaks to so many people.
Well, and different reporters do different things with
totally
it.
Totally different.
One of my favorites is Robert Smith and some of the things fantastic. That he's able to do.
One of our favorites is Mandalita El Barco.
Of course.
I mean, we're biased. But
I think she's in the house.
She's right over there.
Give her a hand. Veteran reporter.
Yeah, you can be incredibly creative, but it is definitely a format, and we decided very consciously to not stick to that. And I think it's exciting because Daniel and I come from those different worlds. He brings this amazing narrative style from his literary work, and I have my background in NPR format reports, and so we meet somewhere in the middle, and we butt heads. Actually, you know, because I'm very trained in what I do, but I'm excited to go in that direction and vice versa.
But you're a check and balance on it.
Exactly.
I'm the long form narrative novelist, right?
Yeah. I rein him in sometimes.
Daniel, your connection to Latin American the writers is very strong. Etiqueta Negra is the name of the magazine that you edited. Tell me what's happening in Latin America, in Peru, other places with the novelists, and is there an overlap with radio or with the novelists doing radio or other storytelling in other formats?
Well, I think some of the most exciting writers, young writers in Latin America today are not novelists or story writers, but journalists.
Give me some names.
You know, Julio Villanueva Chang, Marco Avilés, Gabriela Wiener, Cristian Alarcón, Diego Osorno. You know, there's great magazines published, you know, in Mexico and Colombia, in Peru and Argentina, in Brazil, Chile, certainly. And a lot of them are students who came out of the Fundación de Nuevo Periodismo in Cartagena, in Colombia. And this is the foundation that García Márquez started to support journalists. And, you know, writers from The New Yorker, like John Lee Anderson and Susan Orlean went to teach there. Richard Kapuscinski, the great reporter, went to teach there. And it's like everyone that went there, you know, in the mid-90s went back to their country and started a magazine. And you know, El Malpensante, Amphibia, The Clinic in Chile, Letras Libres, you know, all these amazing magazines. And because I worked with Etiqueta Negra, we had connections with all these people, and we're trying to get, you know, merge the talent of producers here in the States and these amazing storytellers in Latin America, because there's people who know how to tell great stories, they just haven't ever told them in audio. So that's where I think Radio Ambulante fits in, you know, within Latin America. And we do consider ourselves a Latin American project, and we do consider the United States a Latin American country, by the way, you know? I mean,
that's right.
I mean, if there's 50 million Latinos living here, 50 million, 55 million in the last census, you know, Hispano parlantes, I mean, that's more than Peru, you know. Peru's definitely Latin American, so why wouldn't the U.S. be?
So where do you want to take Radio Ambulante? Because, I mean, NPR is not going to air Spanish language stories.
Maybe not yet. Well, we're really seeing the potential unfold before us. You know, we had this crazy idea that people would be interested in something like this. In Latin America, they have not heard something like this at all. They think NPR is that format we were talking about, that is crazy, because they don't hear 4 to 5 minute stories on the radio. So it's a risk. We're hoping that this is going to, I think, I'll speak for myself. I'm hoping that this is going to open an appetite for long form narrative storytelling on the radio. That in a continent, in various continents, where the radio is still so, it penetrates the market's amazing, how many people still listen to radio around Latin America, that they can find this type of intellectual and also funny and entertaining and human oriented storytelling, and hopefully they'll love it, and then we'll be able to not only create that market and open it up, but also the people who are making that radio start connecting the dots. Because there, as Daniel said, there are many, many, many talented journalists who could benefit from learning how to do radio the way we do it, or, you know, and vice versa, we could learn also.
A couple of years after coming to KPCC, the station sent me to the Third Coast Festival, mm-hmm. you know, Ira Glass's, you know, big conference on public radio. And it was great. It was super exciting. They were giving an award to Joe Frank, the great radio producer from longtime KCRW radio producer, Walter Murch, this sound designer for movies. And the most disappointing thing for me is that it was a Latino-free zone.
Oh, yeah.
And this was 9 years ago, more or less. And I just, unless there were any crypto Latinos in the audience, I didn't really see anybody. And that was disappointing, although, you know, it was great charging of the bad radio batteries for me. You guys are letting on that there are a lot of, that's changing, right? That there are a lot of Latinos coming out of journalism school.
We're going to be there. We'll be at Third Coast. Nice. Okay, to give you a sense of the change, you know, and they have been following our work already. And so it is changing. It is, people are paying attention. People are like,
they couldn't do it. They couldn't do this.
I don't know. I mean, you know, not to say they couldn't, but, you know, I mean, this is not an idea that yeah. like, only we had. You know, it seems like you had the idea, Mandalit had the idea, everyone's been talking about, oh, we need this American Life in Spanish for a very, very long time. It's just someone had to do it,
yeah.
you know?
So
and
yeah, exactly.
So it's happening now. And if, I mean, I think that's people, they get it. They get why it's important. They get why it's very, it's a current idea. It's a dynamic idea. It's now. Yeah. And you don't have to explain it to them. In the United States. In Latin America, we have to do what This American Life did 15, 20 years ago, which is teach people how to listen to it, you know? And so far, the responses we've got are telling us that people are getting it. You know, we're getting emails every day from Ecuador, Colombia, Argentina, Mexico. It's
and people
incredible.
Want to contribute. I've seen your Twitter feed, and people say, quiero contribuir, aquí está mi curriculum, ¿no?
Yeah. Or you know, here's my story, you know? We're doing names, and up on Twitter, we had all these people telling us the story of their names for our next episode, which is Nombres, yeah.
Well, I know your background's and you know, most of the people in the crowd, a lot of people in the crowd are Latinos, but I just have an affinity to that. You know, it's a conversación de, I'll give you an example. So I work about 5 blocks away from here at the Second and Figueroa Bureau for KPCC, and every once in a while I'll take a walk, so I'll take a walk over to Bunker Hill. And the ladies who clean the offices will probably about 4 or 5 o'clock start, you know, just talking down at the very bottom floor, the lobby. And man, están platicando tan a gusto. And, you know, it reminds me so much of my aunts and my uncles in Mexico City and everything. And you know, I feel like just plopping down and just, well, I'll listen, but just joining them or something like
yeah.
that, right?
I mean, you know, storytelling is, you know, everyone's got someone in their family who won't shut up. You know, I mean, it's all Latinos do, certainly. Yeah. And, you know,
habla hasta por los codos.
Sí, exactly. And, you know, I think, you know, if you a lot of times those are the people you want to talk to. Sometimes not, you know, but
make sure you have like a 4 gig sound card.
Yeah, right.
Like
right.
Well, that's what's so cool about what we're hoping this is going to do is connect people to their homeland. You know, you can hear a story from Peru. And you might be in, you know, an immigrant in, I don't know, like Idaho. And but it's, you know, you're connecting these dots. And that's why it's so, the name is so apt, because it's just moving around. And also, I love what Maureen said in the beginning of the show. It's like, that's who we're speaking to. It's incredibly It's a population on the move and connecting and making those connections.
We're gonna let's get some questions. Let's get the mics out. I also like that the word ambulancia is also related to, because you're bringing aid, first aid.
Right. Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, I did want to say one thing that you know, one of the things that people told us when we first started was that you know. Oh man, Mexicans only want to hear stories about Mexico, and Puerto Ricans only want to hear stories about Puerto Rico. And you know, if a Bolivian's listening and there's a story about Argentina, they'll turn it off out of nationalism or something. And I just don't believe that's the case. And I do feel that the current cultural and technological moment allows for a really easy and natural and fluid conversation across borders that couldn't have existed.
There's a pan-Latin Americanism. I mean, Mexicans joke about Argentinians all the time, man.
Yeah, but you know, I mean,
and Argentinians,
joke about them,
especially Uruguayos too. They joke about. So, I mean, we want to be part of that conversation, right. You know, and we want to help build it.
Okay, let's hear.
Right here.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Natasha, and I live here in Los Angeles, and I work with the Latino population here. My question is your financial support for the program that you have for Radio Ambulante. You were talking in the beginning that a lot of people who are Trader Joe shoppers, who have a master's, well, that's not the majority of the Latino population that we see here. Mm-hmm. It may be the equivalent of that of the Latinos from other countries. But how then do you get the financial support to be able to continue this when the Latino population here are not the people that necessarily shop at Trader Joe's that has the master's program to be able to financially support?
Well, that's a great question. We did a campaign to get off the ground in February. We had more than 600 backers from more than a dozen countries to support to get us through the end of this first season. We were aiming to raise $40,000, and we raised more than that, $46,000, which is enough to get us started. You know, I'm not going to lie, it's not going to get us very far, but it's going to get us far enough, we hope, to be able to produce the content that's going to draw in audiences. The thing is that's amazing about this particular moment with the tools that we have, technological tools, we don't have to have 75,000 listeners in LA, you know? We can have 5,000 listeners in LA and 5,000 listeners in the Bay and, you know, we can have 2 listeners in Idaho, that Peruvian you were mentioning. We can have listeners, who are learning Spanish at universities, and we're getting hits from more than 80 countries, you know? And because we can aggregate relatively small audiences and hopefully convince some of those people to donate, because we are, 501c3, tax-deductible donations accepted, we hope that in aggregate we'll be able to create that audience. You know, we don't want to be an elitist project, which is why we aim to get on the air on radios. Not everyone has an iPhone in their pocket. I don't, although I'd want one. That's part of our goal. You know, I mean, I'm a novelist. I don't know much about balancing my checkbook or anything, but I'm nothing but optimistic.
And for the record, there are a lot of rich Latinos.
There are.
Yeah. I was going to say that. Like, you'd be surprised. You know, demographics are not always what you see in mainstream media. So.
Yeah. I just know there's like some, Google engineer like living, like 3 blocks from me in San Francisco, who has so much money, doesn't know what to do with it, and is going to hear Radio Ambulante and say, you know what, this is an important cultural project that I've got to, sink my stock options into. And if you know that person,
give him a call.
Give him a call and give him our website. And
we got a couple more. Yep.
Hey. Hi. My question is, I listen to KPCC, I listen to KCRW, I listen to KPFK. What, as like an NPR listener, can we do to change? I mean, is there something we can do to change? I mean, there's Santa Monica and Pasadena, sort of like the whiteness is covered in LA. Like, what can we do to change that?
to change sort of what you hear on the radio? Well, you know, I work at a local affiliate in San Francisco named KALW, and I don't know how it works. Every station's different, but I know that we pay attention when our listeners get in touch with us. Every letter that comes in, especially if it comes with a check, let me tell you, someone's reading it, and someone cares what you say. So I really believe in the power of you picking up the phone and calling your local station and saying, you know what, I really would like to hear more Spanish language media, or I would really like to hear more positive coverage of Latinos, or more diverse coverage of Latinos. Check out this show. It's brand new, and it's public radio, and it's nonprofit, and you can pick it up. It is available. Our programming is not likely to be heard on an NPR station, but that does not mean that it can't be.
And here's another reason that stations would probably not have an excuse anymore, is that a lot of public radio stations have very developed websites, and you're going to tell me that you're not going to put something like this on your website?
You know, KALW is our home station. They have not a minute of, you know, Spanish language broadcasting, but they want to be involved in a project like ours. So I really encourage you to just get in touch. They listen.
We got a question over here.
Yeah, I just you're living on a digital platform, correct?
Right now, yeah.
Do you see growth in a terrestrial, like where ratings equal revenue? Do you see growth on a terrestrial radio or a terrestrial platform at all with this show in this format?
You know, I think it's very important. That's a great question. I think it's important for us to be on terrestrial radio. For this first season, we're enjoying the freedom of the podcast. You know, like not having to fit a 29-minute or 52-minute, 54-minute, you know, leave a news hole and all these kind of questions. So we're letting the stories sort of breathe at whatever pace they want to breathe. But in Latin America specifically, it is important for us to be on the radio, you know, because not everyone's gonna hear it unless we are. And we've had a lot of interest from stations in Colombia and in Peru and Argentina. And I think that's part of where we want to be.
But see, Daniel, if you had the TuneIn app, you'd be able to hear some of those Latin American radio stations.
I do. I listen to TuneIn all the time, man. We listen to the Euro Copa Europa on the way down here in the car on my wife's iPhone, and that's where I decided I'm like, I need to get one of these, man.
Yeah.
There's other things that we can think about that we've been thinking about. For example, cutting up segments that might go on commercial Latino radio, which is where Latinos hear radio. You know, Piolín, you know, gets a gazillion listeners every morning, and you know, would Piolín's listeners want to hear Reza tell his story? Maybe, maybe not. But you know, I'm not willing yet to discard that idea.
Do we have a question over here?
Hi, how are you guys?
Hi, great.
Hi.
First of all, I want to thank you guys for doing this. This is very important.
Thank you.
Secondly, I was wondering, how do you guys curate your material? Like, who chooses? Because the Hispanic market is so vibrant and so widespread that I'm sure you have opportunities at every corner for a story. So how do you guys cut it down and curate what you guys go after and what you don't go after with such limited resources?
That's a good question. We have a small editorial team that we try to look for variety geographically for an episode. So that helps. You know, if we have two stories that are really similar coming from, you know, two different countries, we might choose one because we wanted to spread it out a bit to represent more more populations. But we've worked on stories that didn't work out, that were really good ideas that just didn't pan out. It's really a matter of being very close contact and touch as a team and making sure that they're strong and that they can work in radio. Some stories just are wonderful when you describe them in a half, you know, in a paragraph. But as we roll them out, we see that some just are better, work better than others.
And we draw on a lot of the journalists that we know. You know,
yeah.
So for our first episode or for our audio sampler, you know, I called up Cristina Alarcón, works in Buenos Aires, and we call up Gabby Wiener, who's a friend of mine, colleague from Etiqueta Negra. And the other stories we went and found ourselves, you know. And that was just to get the ball rolling. And now that we have a sound that people can say, you know, listen to this, then people can say, oh, I have an idea. And it sort of builds on itself, you know. But I've worked as an editor, so I think I have the sense of what a good story is. And And you know, sometimes someone tells you a pitch, and you're just like, "Yeah, let's go, let's do that." And
Daniel, talk about the soccer story in the first episode.
Well, that's not in the first episode. It was in our audio sampler. It's going to be redone for our. It's going to be in our football episode, which is coming out in September. This famous team, River Plate from Buenos Aires, you know, like the New York Yankees of Latin American soccer.
The winningest Argentinian soccer team.
Yeah, they
110 years old.
There's a Boca fan up there. well, so last year, actually 1 year ago today, River descended to the B, la Segunda División. So it's like the Yankees getting dropped to like the minor leagues, and it was tragic. And one of the things that happened immediately after was during the last game, the last playoff game, the last 20 minutes of the game, when it was clear that River was going to lose, the announcer, the soccer announcer, Attilio Costafebre on national radio, lost his mind and stopped narrating what was happening on the pitch and just did this beautiful rant, almost a tortured love letter to his team.
Expletives.
And you know, he kept saying these things like, ratas. Hijos de puta, ¿dónde está la guita? You know, I can't do the Argentine accent.
Talking about the owners and the managers.
And just told off. He was like, destruyeron a River, hijos de puta.
But he had a moment of lucidity where he realized what he was doing, right?
Esto no me importa si me cuesta la carrera. And it's great because what we did was, this tape that went viral and someone put it on YouTube and like my wife's sister sent it to us. She's a crazy soccer fan. She sent it to us, and I loved it. And I called up Cristian in Buenos Aires, and I was like, do you know this guy? Can you find him? Can you interview him? And we did this beautiful interview with him where he talks about, you know, what he was feeling in that moment and how he felt he was representing, you know, all of River Plate, you know, fandom. And he said this amazing thing. He's like, I think that the fall of River Plate is probably one of the 50 most important cultural events in the history of Argentina. And he prefaced the statement by saying, I don't want to exaggerate, but... And that's when you're like, this guy's a real fan. You know, this guy. It's just like everything he sees is through the prism of River. It's a soccer story, but it's like something that anyone who cares about humanity can listen to this guy's voice and hear, feel the pain in it.
It was great. It was great. Okay, we're going to take two more questions here. We got a question over here.
Not a question, but just... Are you aware, or anybody in this auditorium aware of KXLU?
Tell us about it.
KXLU has the most Latino programming in all of L.A. KXLU station of Loyola Marymount.
Okay.
And all weekend long, they do nothing but Latino programming.
Where is it on the dial? What is it?
88.9.
Okay. 88.9.
It's a completely non-commercial station.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that shout out.
We'll let two questions.
Have you approached any of the Pacifica network stations? They have a station in Los Angeles as well as in the Bay Area, or KCET, which recently got off of NPR?
Well, TV, KCET operates a television station. Right. Yeah. All right. Well, networks, KPFK?
Well, we are in the process of now figuring out a distribution plan. So no, the answer is no. But we are very open to, as Daniel said, we're looking for anyone that wants to, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, commercial or non-commercial, but also just that maintains the integrity of what we're trying to do. And it is clear about our mission.
Thank you.
Yeah. And do we have one more question somewhere? Anywhere? En español, en inglés?
Ah, sí, nos estamos olvidando de los...
River returned to the first division last weekend. So
that's right.
That's true.
I would suggest that you go back to the guy and get his response.
Yeah, no, we're going to have to re-edit. We're going to have to edit that piece again.
All right, before we wrap up, we also want to talk a little bit about the KCRW radio producers out in the lobby.
Sure.
I think they're doing a great job. Do you want to say something about
that? Yeah, Sonic Trace is doing this really amazing project. They're our friends, Anayansi Diaz-Cortez and Eric Pierce Chavez, working with KCRW. And what they're doing is trying to map L.A. back to the countries where Angelinos come from. So, or the places they come from in the Americas. So I would just encourage everybody to talk to them on the way out, and check in and sort of tell your story with them.
Bueno, muchas gracias, Daniel, Martina, todos los demás.
Okay.
Can we bring everyone out?
Yeah.
And yeah.
Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.